You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Roger Herman. He's an artist and a professor at UCLA. Roger, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's talk about what you're doing now in your studio. What's happening at the moment? What are you working on?
I work on two things. In my studio itself, I work on like some woodcuts that are some are pretty large, some are small. But most of the time, I'm working on ceramics. In the last, like I would say, 12 years, I have started a whole practice that I started from kind of a disdain of ceramics to I got involved pretty deeply to a point where it becomes nearly obsessive, and I don't know quite the reason why it came sort of from behind. And the work on these ceramics, first of all, there was I didn't pay that much attention in terms of art. It gave me a specific freedom to work on these things that initially started as a formal vessel, and then I started to draw on them. Things that I would never dare to draw on my real drawings or paintings. It became nearly like a secret hobby, you know, and
right.
It has sort of evolved into these massive pieces in some weird way.
Is that what you're working on right now? Is it a massive piece, or what is the...
Yeah, well, massive in a way that I made some pretty large ones in the last years, but right now they are actually small, but massive in terms of numbers. It just becomes these little objects that are kind of handmade and painted on and then glazed, and you have it. And there's this kind of competition that I have with a two-dimensional work, with a painting or woodcuts, where I run always into like a dead end somewhere, and then I have to look at these ceramics where I have absolutely no problem in making them or go forging ahead with this, you know, I don't know, it's a sort of I'm much more uninhibited with them than I am with the woodcuts or paintings.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It makes sense. They seem too inexhaustible in there.
I haven't really figured this out, why I have those restraints, whether it's just the history or... I mean, I hate to address the ceramics with this, what is very trendy right now, this kind of a what do you call it, when it's unskilled trend of ceramics, because ceramic is loaded with this history and, you know, the glazes and the clay bodies and the firing and all this. And I don't really know much about that, but I'm not against it, but I'm actually, it gives me a freedom, you know, like I'm not obsessed with that quality that a lot of ceramicists are obsessed with. And they are looking in horror at this wave of people coming in, de-skilled or unskilled, or, you know, it's a little bit like bad art, but then I don't want to, you know, embrace that either that much, you know. I'm a little bit weary of
right.
that trend, you know. But what happened is, I think maybe the surface itself, because it's round and or it's sculptural, I basically use those ceramics to paint on or make an image on. And I felt as if I have no responsibility for choosing an image, even, because after all, you put it through a process afterwards, and then something comes out that you feel surprised and maybe not quite as responsible for the act. You know, I don't know. It's
sure.
an odd thing. Whereas with the image that I make on these woodcuts, I feel what I do is what comes out. And then lately I have been aggressively painting over those woodcuts to kind of destabilize whatever the structure is. And then I made them even more, I put them even more away from the painting on the wall by making books out of them. And they're quite large. They're like 30 by 25 inch books, and they're, you know, maybe 40 pages.
And oh, that sounds beautiful. And they're original woodcuts in there?
They're original woodcuts, and then you can kind of flip through them. So consequently, you don't really, you know, look too long on an image, and then there's also a reference from one to the next that gives you a sequencing, you know, that, because I have always worked, even when I did paintings, I always liked to work in series. You know, there would be like 12 images of a building, and they were the same building, the same painting, but every time it was kind of different. And in the books, it makes really sense, you know, they stay together. And
let's talk about one of the books then that maybe happened or happened. Walk us through the narrative of that or the non-narrative.
Because
it sounds like a gorgeous object too. I mean, I love woodcuts and books, and the paper I'm sure is beautiful. So take us through one of those.
I basically print various imageries. I started this with a friend, Laura Owens. She made a book project, so she asked different people to make books, and I didn't really, you know, she wanted to make two books. And then I ended up with making probably 500 pages because, you know, I just was making them. And then I said, wow, and then I edit them together, sometimes pretty randomly, sometimes more logically, and then I have somebody bind them. I bound some myself. What was actually pretty successful, it's only the binding is not that stable. But then, so I had a professional person really bind them and mount them sometimes on a chipboard. And then what happened, books...
Before you go on, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
You said you had 500 pages. Is that 500 woodblocks?
It's like...
That's pretty obsessive. That's great, but that's really kind of a...
That's the nature of
like
printing, too, you know. My walls were filled, and then I had them all put away into these books, so I made, like, maybe 25 books, and these books are... Then I look at some of them, and I think, oh, my God, these are really terrible. So I started painting in the books after they were even already bound, and... Some of them turned out pretty good. Some of them are still in the process. And some are left completely alone. They're just pure woodcuts.
Right.
So it's a bit like the same nature of, it's like production, but also this kind of a narrative going through. Sometimes it's figurative, sometimes it's not. There's no real boundary on that, you know.
Do you know the artist? There was an artist in books I used to love to collect by Franz Masuriel.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing
guy, right?
Is he
from Belgium or somewhere? He's from my region.
I think so.
Yeah.
And, but I always thought those were gorgeous books, and that reminds me of this a little bit. I mean,
his are much more woodcut.
Expressionist, yeah.
An expressionist in this kind of vein of the man in the city. I have a little one that somebody gave me. Yeah, they are really amazing cuts. What I really liked, I just discovered all these woodcuts by Nolde, just by the sheer, even the tiny ones, they look so monumental and beautiful. And I have always liked woodcuts. I never got into other printmaking techniques, even that the woodcut could be made with silkscreen by now, but it doesn't have that physical aspect of it. Plus, I make them myself. I don't have a press. I rub them with a wooden burl or whatever you call it.
Oh, burl, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's a bit also like revisiting, going back, making it again, working through it, a little bit like the ceramics, because ceramics also I have to... rework, refire sometimes, you know, less and less. I'm in this lucky position of really loving them, but there's this compulsiveness. I was driving, the other day home from school because I use the lab at UCLA. We have a big ceramic lab with all the kilns and all that, and there was nobody there because it's a break. And I was driving home, and I had a few pots in my car, and I knew they were not ready. So on the freeway, I turned around and went back, and I reglazed them. So I mean, it's like a bit of an obsessive thing right now.
Right. Well, obsessive really works in this case.
Yeah, it does.
For artists, obsessive works.
So
what's coming up? So this is what you're working on, and
as
you're growing both these mediums, what will be the next show? How will you present them together or not?
I have a show right now. I just opened yesterday in Paris. It's a group show with a bunch of ceramicists who are also more artists than ceramicists, you know, so it's a group of different people. And then I'm in a few shows, mostly ceramics, and I'm planning a show here in the gallery that I show with Richard Tellus, where we are planning to put them maybe in context with other things that are not necessarily ceramics. But I'm working on that. I haven't really figured that out. That's sort of an idea that was put to me, and then I have to chew on that. I don't really know how to go about it. But yeah,
you have a gallery in L.A. now.
Yeah, well, Richard Tellus. I don't have a gallery as much as a gallery has me. I work with different galleries. Like right now, I have a show at Roberts and Tilton in L.A., and I have a show at Acme with works on paper. But the gallery who supposedly represents me, you know how the art world is. I have no idea anymore.
Right.
What is doing what. The official gallery is Richard Tellus, who is,
So let's talk a little, let's go back a little bit. I'd like to talk about maybe how you came into the art world, just to kind of begin a lot of this and talk about also the first artist collective in Chinatown and just how you began getting involved in the art.
Oh, yeah, well, that was a long time ago. I was a law student in Germany first. I studied unsuccessfully a few years law. I hated it, and then I went to art school in an academy in Karlsruhe, and the main people there were like Baselitz, Lüpertz, Kirkeby, and they left a big impression even that I was always looking over their shoulder to Düsseldorf because there was like Polke and Richter and all these people, but we were not allowed to look at them. We were a very conservative school, so it always was this kind of dilemma. And then I moved to the United States. I had a grant from the DAAD to after a postgraduate grant, and I stayed a year and a half. And then I stayed, and I moved to Los Angeles in 81, and that was it, yeah. So I never lived much in New York. I didn't really know the United States. I first moved to San Francisco, and then to Los Angeles.
The gallery that you opened...
Oh, that was much later in Chinatown. I was teaching already at UCLA, and I thought, oh, we should have an artist space in Chinatown. There were all these stores available, and there was a China Art Object started a place with Jorge Pardo, and then we started a place. And it started a whole movement in Chinatown that lasted a few years, and then it vanished. But we mostly showed...
Right, that was very lively. I remember I interviewed Jorge Pardo not long ago, and he talked about that.
Yeah, he was...
I think it was called The Garage or something, right?
No, they had a pretty nice... Well, he had also a bar, and he had a pretty big gallery space with some other fellow students from Art Center. They opened this place together, and they were more serious gallery. We were more like a space where we gave the artists the keys, and they could work on a show a few months, and then we would do a show. And at the beginning, we didn't have an opening. We just had an opening and a closing. We never even had We didn't have a phone. We had nothing. And then it emerged. I mean, it developed into some kind of a real thing. At the end, we were having artists and representing artists and going to art fairs. And it snowballed into something bigger than we wanted. So we kind of quit. Because
and you were a professor at UCLA then as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, that really did launch a whole big scene. There was a lot of people from those galleries that, you know, maybe it was the right timing or all kinds of things, but sure.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people went.
A lot of careers.
Yeah, a lot of people did come through there, like Rye Rockland and Nick Lowe, and there was tons. I mean, David Cordy.
Through artist-run galleries, essentially, that weren't.
Yeah. Well, Los Angeles is a little bit like that. Now it is changing because big galleries move here, but in the, I would say in the 90s, it was all driven by the art schools, because it's such a spread out city and there's this big community of, and there's, I think we have 5 art schools here, and that became like a center, you know, there's no bars or restaurants or, so all of a sudden, the communication happened through the schools, and that was a big plus. And I mean, it still probably is to a degree, where the artists are in great numbers and a lot of artists, but there is less of platforms than, let's say, New York or in other cities, maybe, or London.
Right.
But it's changing. It's really changing.
So let's talk about a little bit of the changing landscape and also about teaching. As a fine arts professor, you've been there for a while. UCLA is a school that's talked about almost mythic in the arts, like Yale and these other schools that have these studio programs. In brief, what do you think, and you can take this anywhere, but
yeah,
do artists need to have an education, and is it always helpful, let's say, the BFA or MFA, and we're not? You know,
well, I mean, considering the amount they're paying in tuition, it's probably not. I feel so bad. You know, I come from Germany where, you know, basically tuition is free for everybody, even if they are from the state, you know, foreigners. There is no tuition. It's minimal. It's like $40 a year or something for a student body. But here it has become now 30, 40 grand a year. And I think the only reason really to go to art school is to have a community, you know, like of like-minded people, because the world itself is not really that interesting. You know, 98% of the people are not really interested in the arts or in the art world as it's taught in schools. So
right.
They have a really good babying in the beginning in the community and exchange, but I remember John Baldessari telling me always that you just take a bunch of people, put them together. He always thought to teach was not really a possibility, even that he was a great teacher, but he said you just put a bunch of smart people together and they figure it out themselves. I mean, you cannot really teach somebody to make art, you know, it's like they have to figure it out themselves. You have to kind of create the possibility or the platform where they can work, and that's, I think, the good part, to have a lot of good people around you who are inspiring. But otherwise, I don't know how you can really teach art. I mean, I'm still learning. I have to teach myself everything.
Well, the world has changed a lot. I mean, even since the Chinatown, I mean, everything keeps evolving, obviously, but there's in the arts in L.A. and what's happening in terms of admission in school and growing numbers of students. How have you seen things change to an extent that the art world is viewed differently? Success is thought of more, professional development of artist careers, you know, paying back their tuition is a big issue now because they can't live in the big cities and so easily. How has that changed? I mean, for good or worse, what do you see happening from your perspective there in terms of?
I think it has gotten just more of everything. Like I think right now, I think the LA or Southern California is producing probably 300 graduate students, MFAs, every year. They pump them out. It's like a machine, right? And then we have it's just more of everything. So we have also more people now who get picked up even in grad already by big galleries. I have some students in grad school. I won't mention them, but you walk into their studio and you have a meeting, and they already have they have to go to Milan because they have a show, or they tell me, this is my assistant. You know, I have hired this student who's working for me right now, this undergrad. And so there's that, and then you have the mass of all these other kids who are going out of school and they are working at the pizza joint, you know, so there's, it's more of everything, more success, but also more no success, you know. It is just a very harsh reality, and I think it has become so incredibly commercial. So if you are very plugged in right away, it's very beneficial for some students or some young artists. You know, and I don't want to judge it. It has probably always been that way, one way or the other. There is very little room to be, you know, honest and for them and. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. But in Europe, do you think that's the same in Europe? I mean, we are talking about the United States
I think it's all connected. I think it's all interconnected. I mean, the big players are in Europe. I mean, Hauser & Wirth and, you know, all the big auction houses are everywhere, right? I mean, there's a big there's a big machine doing it. Not to you know, say it's a corporate entity or whatever, but it is a big machine.
Sure.
And there is a big, demand and from people who are maybe differently interested in art than maybe it used to be. But I don't want to be, you know, one of those old folks who are complaining about how it used to be and how it shouldn't be.
Right, it's just changed, you know. It's just
it changes, changed. Yeah, yeah.
And as you're saying, there's more artists now. So
yeah. I mean, if I go online and watch the news, on the right of my screen, I have Paddle 8 come up all the time, you know. I don't know how I get rid of it.
Artists are listening to this. Is there anything you want to say in closing? Could be.
Yeah, well, it is not. I mean, I feel really terrible sometimes that these kids get to these programs and then they are really lost, you know. It's not like we're teaching them solid something, you know. It's all very vague,
right.
You know. Kind of swimming around there. What is part of being an artist, but at the same time. And I, like I said before, I have a few students. I mean, they're so plugged in already. They don't even show up for their own MFA show because they have too many shows to work on. And it's kind of insane. You know, they're 26 years old and they have like, show in Brussels and shows here in Milan. And
right. Well, Robert Storr said something about, you know, it's sort of survival of the fittest. You know,
right.
If you can handle it, if you can get through it, you can get through school, you can get through those terrible crits maybe and all that stuff and survive. You'll probably make it. That's probably what you need to make it.
Well. It's I wonder. I mean, there's a lot of other things, elements too that you can't really teach. You know how you're plugged in there and how.
Well, it doesn't really leave room for like the sensitive introvert. You know that. Can't wither. You know, punches, and I think those kind of people exist. And the idea that an artist has to be someone who's confident and also a bit of a warrior is
right. Yeah.
No.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.